And it's true that I didn't prepare a transparency talk, but I did prepare one slide. Here it is. So one strategy in a math talk is to give the theorem at the beginning without a lot of explanation, and so here it is. So the theorem is going to classify a certain bunch of field theories. It's definitely a theorem in field theory, not in lattice systems. So n is the space-time dimension. So if we're talking about a 3 plus 1 dimensional system, n is 4. It has a symmetry group, which I'm calling Hn. And here's a little chart to tell you some typical cases. So if the theory just has bosons and no time reversal symmetry, then the Hn is Son. If the theory has fermions, or may have fermions, not necessarily, but they're allowed, and still no time reversal, then it's spin-n. If we now have time reversal symmetry and again only bosons, then it's the orthogonal group On. And if we have both fermions allowed and time reversal symmetry, then it's a two-component group, which is a double cover of the orthogonal group called Pn. And there are two flavors of it, Pn plus and Pn minus. And that depends on whether the time reversal squares to minus one to the grading operator on the Hilbert space or whether it squares to the identity. And then if we have a global symmetry group, and here by global, I mean not including time reversal because that's already done, then we just take one of the previous cases, and in the simplest case, we cross with G. But there are more complicated cases where the G and the other group could interact a little bit. So that's just to give you a more concrete sense of what this Hn is. And in listening to the talk, you can just imagine it's the case of Son, certainly. Okay. So what we want to talk about are invertible, our field theories, which have two key properties. One is they're topological, and secondly, they're invertible. I'll explain later what invertible means, but for now you can think that it means that on any space, which is n minus one dimensional, there's unique vacuum. That's a consequence of invertibility. And if we want to classify these things up to deformation, which is the problem of phases, say, in this field theory context, then it's a fact that, or theorem if you like, myself and Mike Hopkins and Constantine Telemann for a while, that deformation classes of these n-dimensional invertible field theories with that symmetry are given by a certain abelian group, which belongs to stable homotopy theory. So I don't think there are too many people here who are stable homotopy theorists. And so for the moment, that'll be a little bit of a black box, but yeah, I'm going to explain that in a second. So this is a certain space of maps, and I'll explain a little bit what it is. The new idea in the talk is to include reflection positivity, which is the Wick rotated version of unitarity. And then we have the deformation classes of these theories, which are reflection positive with the same symmetry. And the answer changes slightly to this. So these spaces that occur here in the domain, these are spaces having to do with Bordism. This is a space that that René Thom introduced way back in his thesis in 1954. It's an incredible thesis to calculate Bordism classes of manifolds.
So,
no, I mean MTH. I'll explain, I promise. But it's good to get it in stereo, actually. It's much better than mono, I must say. It's quite an institute here. So this is, in fact, this is related, as you suggested, to a Thom space. And it's one that Thom spectrum, we might call MH perp. So there's a change. The T could be thought of there as tangential. And the Thom space has to do with the stable normal bundle. But I'm not going to explain that detail for the moment. But this is something to do with Thom Bordism, whereas the field theories without the reflection positivity have to do with a kind of truncated form, which is due to Madsen and Tillman. So here the MT could be thought of as Madsen-Tillman or as tangential. So let me just define these a little bit, and then I'll remark. So these symmetry groups, they all have a homomorphism to the orthogonal group, just by their action on, say, in the Euclidean version, by which I mean flat Euclidean space. They act as kind of point symmetries. And so there's a homomorphism like that. And they also come in a sequence. where these are actually inclusions. And this diagram not only commutes, but it's a pullback square. And, so this goes on. And we can take a limit, really co-limit, of these groups. And you might think of it as a kind of H infinity, O infinity. I'll leave off the infinity, H, O. So they're kind of limiting stable groups like that. And this this MTHN that occurs, I mean, I'm just going to define it for some people in the audience, it's a certain Thom spectrum over BHN of a virtual bundle, which is constructed using this representation. And this MTH is a limit. As n goes to infinity, these things, the suspensions sit inside, one sits inside the next, and we can take their limit. Anyway, that's just so we have a precise definition. And I should also say what the target is. This IZ is a spectrum which is called the Anderson dual to the sphere spectrum. All right, so that's just so we have a precise statement. What is what? Bracket means homotopy classes of maps. Sorry.
What does Anderson dual mean?
Anderson dual means something that I'll perhaps explain in a bit. But I just wanted to have a precise statement if there's anybody for whom those words mean something. But now I'm going to try to say something about it. Yeah?
A very naive question. Physically, what does N represent? Is that just
N? Yeah. N is the dimension of space-time. So in the previous discussions where it's 2 plus 1, n is 3.
And what do you mean by deformation class?
Ah.
I mean, I thought that the topological theory by definition is not something that you can deform. Because it's topological.
Yes, but you could imagine, as with anything, you could imagine making a space of these things. And this is pi naught of that space. I mean, yeah, topological field theories form a space, and this is pi naught of the space. There's a subtlety there that I'll come to, but naively, that's what it means.
Can you define higher pi I of this space?
Yes, correct. And they would just be suspensions of that. Yeah.
What that infinity n kind of view your
TFT? Well, I'll explain that, but that's part of this choice of target. Yes, that's hidden in there. If you like, a spectrum is an infinity n category of a special type. It's a groupoid, and it's a Picard groupoid, and so that's what it is. Yes?
So what are you varying?
What am I varying?
Varying in this whole thing.
Well, so the upshot is that if you give me a dimension and you give me a symmetry group, I claim that we can calculate the deformation classes. Pardon me? Well, you can give me any symmetry group, but yeah, with arbitrary g. So I'll give you some examples in a second. Yes?
Okay, let me get that example.
Okay.
So I guess the same question is, what do you mean by deformation classes of
Let's imagine a theory in two dimensions which assigns to a two-manifold a number lambda to the power Euler characteristic. That number lambda could be any non-zero complex number. Well, that's a family over the non-zero complex numbers. That's a family of topological field theories. That's an example.
And you're going to identify all
of them. That's
deformation.
Yes. That's the claim. Yes?
When you talk about this HN global signature.
Pardon me?
When you use this HN to label all these classes, global signature.
Global symmetry. These are global symmetries. They're not gauge symmetry. There's no gauge symmetry. There's global symmetry. Well, it's SON because, okay, so if we're doing field theory, I'm thinking of starting in Minkowski spacetime, and we always have the Poincaré symmetry. And this is the mod translations. There's the Lorentz symmetry. This is the Wick rotated version. So the minimal thing you have is SON. So I should say that the image in the physics, the image of these maps is either SON or ON, the image of these homomorphisms. Other questions?
The homotopic class are free homotopic classes, no base point.
No, there's a base point.
There will be a base point.
Yes. Other questions? So let me make several remarks, probably the questions have already. So one thing we might ask is, what about lattice systems? So in the application to lattice systems, we have to go from those to a continuum field theory. I can't spell that. And that's a whole big topic. How do you go from something discrete, as we saw in the first slides, this picture of a Hilbert space as a tensor product over sites, how do we go from that to a field theory? That I'm not addressing, but that's where I think a big open question is. But then I'm using that if we have a gap system, as explained in Michael's lecture, the gap system means that this continuum field theory will be a topological field theory. And then I want to say that if we have some property of the lattice system, that will lead to this invertibility property. So I don't know, sometimes it's called short-range entangled, but in a different sense, I think, than Michael said in his lecture. But anyway, that leads to an invertible field theory. Well, these are going to allow those things. Yes?
This is probably the wrong time to ask. It is the right audience to ask this question. Why do we have SON symmetry in the system that is microscopically not relativistic?
Well, let's put that question here.
In other words, I understand why it should be really topological in space, but it's not clear to me why it should be topological in space.
I think that's a great question, and I view that as part of what I said here.
One way to think about this is the boundary of this theory may have anomaly, which you should allow gravitational anomaly. If the SON part is to describe the potential gravitational anomaly of the boundary of this
theory. I don't even see an SON. The gravitational anomaly is a feature of the SON.
Well, since we're not going to resolve it, maybe. As the chairman of the session, I'm going to cut this off. Okay, so of course that's a great question. So as I say, there's a whole can of worms in here. If we want to apply this theorem to lattice systems, okay. But the intuition is that the low energy physics, which is encoded in this continuum field theory. So here we're making this approximation at low energy, that this low energy physics determines the deformation class. So that's something I think was already in the previous talks, and that would lead to this being a classification of deformation classes of lattice systems too. Okay, so I should say that Anton and collaborators have got similar answers in to this kind of classification problem. And also Kitaev has been studying this problem using lattice methods and proves, for example, that these things form a spectrum from some lattice considerations, and in his more speculative moments would get answers. Certainly all the answers are consonant with this, but might even speculate that the answer would be something like that. So this is a theorem in a kind of geometric formulation of quantum field theory, or at least a geometric formulation of parts of quantum field theory, axiomatization, that's been around for a long time. And so part of the talk, since that's unfamiliar, will be to try to explain that at the same time that I explain the new point, which is reflection positivity. So that's really the new point in the talk. Right, and so there's a direct argument that hopefully I'll get to, that the reflection positivity is what takes us from this kind of unstable Bordism to this stable Bordism, that's the crucial ingredient in that classification. So there are two pillars of quantum field theory, locality and unitarity. I think most physicists would agree with that. And the locality is something I think in this geometric formulation that we have even in spades, because we have this notion of an extended field theory that I'll come to. And that's something that's been around in that formulation since the early 90s. And I think it's now that that's being used more and more in the physics, these higher categories and lots of things that are coming in. But the unitarity is not something that in the mathematical formulation is usually put in, this reflection positivity, and for good reason, which is that a lot of mathematical applications of quantum field theories, they're not unitary. But so we want to discuss that, and I think Theo in his talk maybe will discuss something also about unitarity and reflection positivity. Right, so I want to emphasize that this is very computable, these things, and maybe I should say some quick example. So example, supposing that Hn is Son cross G. So that's a bosonic system with a global G symmetry. Then what that group reduces to would be written in that language as homotopy classes of maps from BG with the disjoint base point, to address your point, to the n plus first suspension of some spectrum, which is called IMSO, the Anderson dual of MSO. So what does this look like? Well, so these are maps of spectra, and a spectrum has a kind of decomposition, a Posnikov decomposition, his name also came up this morning, of in terms of the homotopy groups. And this one is pretty simple, because it has just a Z on top and then a bunch of zeros. And what that means is that in low dimensions, if you're calculating this, then what you see is exactly the group cohomology. And that's the group cohomology that several people in this room, I think, identified from the lattice point of view. But as you start to go further, you're going to see other groups. I think they look like this, if I'm not mistaken. And but I think I was checking in my mind, because that came up, that in four dimensions, I think you will only see the group cohomology in 3 plus 1. But I think in three dimensions, you won't. In three dimensions, you'll hit this other Z. You'll see that. And I should say for a finite group in four dimensions, you'll only see the group cohomology, which was written on one of those slides. In three dimensions, you'll see this Z. And that corresponds to this E8 phase and things like that. So those are of a rather different nature than some of these other ones, and those are included in this classification.
So the second Z, the three, two plus one dimension.
Well, it occurs in all the computations. Okay. But if I'm in 2 plus 1 and this is 3, then so to speak, this is in degree 3, 2, 1. How did I get lost?
Which dimension?
4, 3, 2, 1, 0. If I'm calculating 2 plus 1 dimensions, that Z ends up in degree 0. And so that would be a class in 8,0 of this space with coefficients in Z. So I would see it. And that would correspond to this kind of Kitaev E8 phase, if I understand.
So here, this G is a trivial, right? The G is trivial. Only has the
own. Pardon me?
The G is trivial.
No. No, I'm mapping. Sorry, I'm mapping into this.
Oh, I see.
So you should think of this as a generalized cohomology of BG. Of the group. It's a generalized kind of group cohomology.
So these are stable homotopy groups of what? These Z is 0, 0.
These are the homotopy groups of the spectrum.
Okay. Why do you think of IMSO instead of the IZ?
Well, because it became MSO / BG plus, and I moved the MSO to the other side. That's all. So it's just easier to think of it that way, to make contact. But again, I don't expect
so
that you're...
We can understand this sigma n plus 1 and so is some action.
Yeah, let me say the other example and then I'll answer that question.
I
and then I'm going to start talking about elementary things. So this was all the introduction.
So I means dual, yeah?
I means dual in a certain sense.
So
yes.
If you map from something, this is the same as the map to I on that.
Correct, yes. This thing is the maps of the spectrum in top, what I called IZ. Okay, so supposing I do the spin theory, then means the one with fermion, Then we'll get a similar thing, but now we'll have this IM spin. So this is MSO or I. And now when we have IM spin, we have many more homotopy groups. Sorry, they're not lining up. There's a Z, a 0, and then a Z mod 2. And that much of it is what Wen and Gu and Wen discovered in the context of lattice systems, this much cohomology. But it goes on further. There's a Z mod 2 here and a Z and lots more. So those are all part of this. So in low dimensions, again, you would see this this exotic group cohomology mapping into the answer, in fact. That would be a subgroup. Okay. So, so one message is that I think these things are calculable. We even have a postdoc at Texas who's an algebraic topologist raring to calculate. So if you have a dimension in a group, let me know. Pardon me? There should be an app. Well, it's called the Adam spectral sequence. Yes?
So for both of these, there's no obstruction, but for the quantum case, I think there's a various obstruction. So how to do the obstruction?
Well, I say there's a spectral sequence. I mean, those are part of the computation. Those are how those groups are put together. They're not products, and that's part of the computation. That's correct. Okay, so the rest of the lecture, I'm going to have sort of three themes. So one is this relation between field theory and a sort of categorified Bordism, because it's that relation that leads to these answers, to why Bordism is at all relevant. And it's important that these be extended field theories. Well, it's not important, but the answer takes that into account. The second thing is to try to explain why invertibility, well, I'll just say it more, leads to this answer in terms of stable homotopy theory. So these are very computable, as I say, and they're essentially about spaces, maps of spaces. The spaces have more structure, but they're essentially about reducing to some kind of topology where we have spaces. The answer in general, when we don't have invertibility, but we still have topological field theories, that answer is much more complicated. And that's what we've seen, for example, in three dimensions. That's where modular tensor categories come in. What they are in four dimensions in general is not known, and so on. So those are a much more complicated structure. The invertibility very much simplifies the problem and lets us use tools from stable topology to attack it. And the third point is the new point, which is this reflection positivity. So I'll try to give an exposition. I'm obviously going to be way short of time. But okay, so let me start then with quantum mechanics. And in quantum mechanics, we have a Hilbert space. And this Hilbert space is positive definite. That goes without saying, but that's the positivity and reflection positivity. And in fact, let me say from the outset that reflection positivity should be thought of not as a compound noun, but as two nouns, reflection positivity. We'll see that those are two different structures. And the reflection is a structure. You might think the positivity is a condition. In mathematics, we always, from the beginning, distinguish between conditions and data and conditions. And positivity in an ordinary field theory is indeed a condition, but in an extended theory, one of the things we learned is that it's actually a structure. Yes?
Yeah. I always thought that in quantum mechanics, we have Hilbert space with a positive definite.
We do.
And the condition of refraction positivity is an additional requirement, basically the statement that the Hamiltonian is Hermitian.
I'm getting there.
But you said that you already have reflection.
No, I said I already have some positivity that's built in from the beginning by that positive definiteness. I didn't mean that was the end of the story. No, of course not. Okay, sure. So H is our Hamiltonian, which, as Nati said, is self-adjoint. And that's part of the kind of reflection. And what it gives us is a is a one parameter group that takes a time translation t and maps us to e to the minus I t h over h bar. Right? Why are you laughing? I wrote h bar. Well, I learned that I can't add lengths and areas, so I thought. Anyway, so one of the important things that one does, if this is the real line of time translations, is to extend this unitary one parameter group to a semigroup defined on this lower half plane, right? So we let t be a complex number with negative imaginary part. And if the Hamiltonian is in fact non-negative, then these operators get small as I go here, other than the zero eigenvalue. And so in fact, we get a holomorphic family of a holomorphic semigroup of these operators. And usually we restrict those operators then to this imaginary axis, not including. So this is where t is minus I tau. Tau is positive. And so along this axis, we have the semigroup of operators e to the minus tau h. And the reflection symmetry, yes. I didn't say this is the most general quantum mechanics. Yes, h is independent of t. And so the reflection is basically that this operator is real. Yeah, so let me just give a quick example to make the point. It's an example that Nati likes. It's a great institute, but the chalk.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's look at a particle on the circle. So a particle on the circle at time s is at position e to the I x of s, where x is just a real valued function, say. And the Lagrangian is 1 half x dot squared of s ds. That's the thing we integrate. The Hilbert space, when you quantize, is L2 functions on the circle with complex values. And the Hamiltonian is just the Laplace operator. And so the, maybe better to think in terms of the evolution, is that this minus I tau maps to e to the minus tau Laplacian, to this heat operator on the circle. Well, we can make this more interesting by adding a term minus theta times lambda star alpha, say, where alpha is a one form on the circle that integrates to one. So this is a kind of theta term. And when we do that and we quantize, then not mine. And so now we get this theta gives me a line bundle over the circle with holonomy theta, e to the I theta, I should say. And we get the same operator, but acting on sections of this. And now what is this, symmetry? Well, there's orientation. So there's an orientation reversal. Which I should have said from the beginning, that once we put in this theta term, we need to integrate now a differential form. And so we need an orientation of time. Before that, we don't need an orientation of time. And what does orientation reversal do? Well, we could think of it as taking theta to minus theta, taking the Hilbert space to the conjugate, complex conjugate Hilbert space, and taking this operator to the complex conjugate operator. In other words, when I change the sign of theta, the line bundle becomes the complex conjugate line bundle. We get the complex conjugate system. And so the lesson is that orientation reversal goes over to complex conjugation. And that's the most basic example of the reflection part of reflection positivity. The positivity is, as we said, the both the positive definiteness of the Hilbert space and the reality of the Hamiltonian. Now, already here, we can think of.
So once you have this condition, orientation reversal and the complex conjugation, if they are the same, is that equivalent to reflection positivity?
Yeah, I'm saying that the unitarity of the theory is manifest in this Wick rotated version by saying that orientation reversal goes over to complex conjugation. I'll give you the standard quantum field theory formulation in a second, but we already have a kind of Bordism picture. Namely, I want to think that we're going to have manifolds that are zero and one dimensional. To a point, we're going to attach the Hilbert space, a vector space, and to an interval of total length tau, these are Riemannian one manifolds, we're going to attach this evolution, e to the minus tau h, acting on that Hilbert space. And in the case when we need an orientation, it's an orientation interval. So that's the formal structure. In this version, we can write it, as I said, in terms of this Bordism. Now, how does this look in a quantum field theory? Well, again, there's this analytic continuation. I'm not going to remind you about that. But if we've already continued, then we're working on the Euclidean space in n dimensions, n space-time dimensions. And now let's imagine that we have a hyperplane in here. So that's a hyperplane. And suppose first that we look at the correlation function of some operators. I'll just draw them schematically. They might be a bunch of point operators, but they could include line operators, other sorts of things. And let's suppose that the operators are supported on one side of this hyperplane. So if we do the path integral over the correlation function of those operators on this half plane, so let's call this h plus half space and h minus. If we do it on this half space, then we get an element in the Hilbert space, which is really associated to having divided this Euclidean space along a hyperplane. And now there are two properties here. So the reflection property is that supposing, let's call sigma this hyperplane reflection, just the Euclidean symmetry that reflects across this hyperplane, then we can reflect these operators, and we get sigma applied to O. And if the operators were complex, we would have conjugated in there. And if we take the expectation value of these, now on this minus half space, then what I get is the old thing on the plus half space, but complex conjugated. And when I do this reflection, the Hilbert space actually knows about the normal vector. And the normal vector having reversed means that the Hilbert space complex conjugates. So that's the reflection part. And the positivity part is usually expressed by saying that if I do the correlation function now of both sets of operators on the whole Euclidean space, that this is non-negative. Now it's a number because we're doing it on the whole Euclidean space. And that's non-negative simply because it's the norm squared of that vector. Yes. Yes, that's what I meant. I meant do the path integral over the half space. No, it's the path integral over the half space. Naturally, depends on boundary conditions. And as a function of boundary conditions, it's in the Hilbert space. So I agree, it's a funny symbol, but let's move on. OK. Questions about that. So that's the standard formulation of reflection positivity. And Osterwalder and Schrauder proved that if you have a Euclidean field theory with that, then you can get back by this, taking really the boundary values of the analytic thing, you can get back a unitary quantum field theory.
So does it mean that the algebra of operators is it something like a star algebra?
Certainly. OK, so let's talk about the symmetry group. I think so.
So if it's unitary, I understand why.
Yeah, and their theorem is going backwards. Exactly.
So there are no more.
Well, you have to formulate this for. So the operators might not be scalars. They might have indices, if you like. And then what you get is. You might have a vector space of operators, and so if I take that times its reflection, I get a form on that vector space, I get a Hermitian form, and all those Hermitian forms have to be positive or definite. I think that's the condition. So I just wrote the simplest case.
And it's 1-1, but there's a technical assumption.
Well, reflection positivity isn't the only assumption, but again, it's not my purpose to go into the theorem. that's okay. Okay, so I want to say how we get from this kind of standard formulation of reflection positivity to this homotopy theory, right? That's the story I want to tell. So what is the symmetry group? Well, certainly we have translations, Rn, acts as translations. But if I mod out by the translations, those are affine symmetries. If I mod out by the translations, I get vector symmetries on the underlying translation group. And that's the group I'm calling Hn, this Euclidean group of translation symmetries, and of all symmetries mod translations. And that then comes with a homomorphism, as I said, to the orthogonal group simply by virtue of acting on the translations in Euclidean space, on that vector space. Okay, now what I want to do is bring this hyperplane reflection into the story so that we can express this reflection structure, that reflection goes to complex conjugation. I want to express that as part of this symmetry. So I'm going to make a bigger group. I hesitate to call it symmetry group because with this audience I will get that it's not a symmetry, but we're going to make a bigger group, and that bigger group will fit into an extension, Hn hat, by just the group plus minus one. And how do I get this group? Well, this group is actually a semi-direct product every time I fix a hyperplane reflection. So if I fix a hyperplane in Rn and I fix that reflection, then what this group is just Hn semi-direct product, this plus or minus one, where that reflection is conjugating these symmetries. So better maybe to tell you in examples, and you know you're in Canada when you have a hockey stick here, but that doesn't work. That doesn't work either. Okay, how do I get that board now? Okay. That's tricky. Is there another string? I don't see it. As a kid, I played floor hockey, but it's been all tennis since then. Okay, so it's not inner.
Sorry.
Let me give examples. Yeah, it's not inner, but it's always right. So what is this Hn hat? So if I just take Son, I'll get On. Okay, so that's certainly not. And if I take spin n, I'll get pin n plus. So the group Hn hat has twice as many components as the group Hn, of course. And these other components I'm adding are the ones that are going to encode this reflection kind of symmetry. If I start with On, I'll just get a product group. And if I start with the pin groups, well, I'll get some group that doesn't really have a name, but it's a group with four components. In fact, those groups you could define by thinking of the automorphism of the pin group, which is the identity on the identity component, and its multiplication by the central element on the off component, and you would join that automorphism. How does Z mod 2 act on Hn? Well, as we learned in Lukasz's lecture, it's only acts through outer automorphisms, right? It doesn't act through automorphisms. And it's just the outer automorphism gotten by picking a hyperplane and conjugating by that reflection. You have to lift that reflection to here. All right. Pardon me? Yeah, very good. Well, because I decided that that reflection has to act with order 2. I agree. That's yes. For this purpose. I didn't say that the theory can't have symmetry pin minus. I certainly said it could have symmetry pin minus. But this is different. These are not the symmetries of the theory. These are a kind of extended group that's meant to encode the reflection positivity. And I really want that to be an involution. And that's said that I would get called on because I want it to have order 2. So when I take the semi-direct product of the spin group with a reflection and I want it to square to the identity, it's going to be pin plus. In pin minus, it's only the fourth power. It squares to the central element. But you've honed in on a good point. Other questions? Okay. Yes?
Can you explain again what happens when you get time reversals? What example is when it's time reversal? Why do you have another operation?
Well, in the Euclidean signature, when I Wick rotate to Euclidean signature, the time reversal acts linearly, not antilinearly. And this extra symmetry is going to take the Hilbert space to its conjugate. Okay, maybe this extra transformation, let's not use the word symmetry. I realize this is a slightly unconventional way of formulating this, but I think it's an important step for getting to there.
So you have the theory?
No, it's the same theory. I'm just trying to encode what it means to be reflection positive. That's not usually encoded in a group. It's usually encoded as a separate thing. But let me try to go. I know. Because it's going to act differently. The other one acts linearly. And this one, to the extent it acts, is going to act antilinearly. Other questions? Okay. So this axiomatic framework that I referred to, this categorified Bordism, deals with compact manifolds. And so we have to now work on compact manifolds. And these will be compact Riemannian manifolds. So that axiomatization of a field theory is an axiomatization of this Wick rotated version. So even when you think about topological field theories and the relation with modular tensor categories and three dimensions and so on, you should keep in mind that it's always this Wick rotated version that's gone from Euclidean space now to compact Riemannian manifolds. And so now we want compact Riemannian manifolds with this HN structure. And so let me just, that's a rather standard thing. This global symmetry group on Euclidean space now becomes tangential symmetry group of the manifold. And so what it means is, what does it mean for a manifold to have that structure? It means that there's a principal bundle with structure group HN, together with, if I take and apply this homomorphism rho n, then I get a principal bundle with structure group, the orthogonal group. And I already have one, which is the orthonormal frame bundle of M, and I need to give an isomorphism. What is what? M, sorry. So M is a compact n-dimensional Riemannian manifold. It needn't be compact for this discussion. Just an n-dimensional Riemannian manifold, sorry. Thanks. So if HN is SON, this just means an orientation, and this is then the bundle of frames which are both orthonormal, that's what they are here, but also oriented. Right. Okay. So maybe this is a good time to say that what I can do with this extra group is now there's an involution. Let's call it M goes to beta M, which is a new manifold of that type. And the way I can get it is, well, I'll just say it in words. We can take the HN bundle, we can extend to this group HN hat. It'll be a subbundle, and we literally take the complement, which will be a new HN structure. So for example, if HN is SON, when I extend to HN hat, which is ON, we get all orthonormal frames. I take the complement of my oriented ones in there, I get the ones which are oriented for the opposite orientation. So that specializes to orientation reversal. There's an analogous thing on spin manifolds. It's a little more interesting when we have something like pin, because then that involution is actually giving me a new, there's no orientation reversal because a pin manifold doesn't have an orientation and indeed may not have one, but there's a new pin structure you get by tensoring, so to speak, with the orientation double cover. And that's an involution on pin manifolds, which is the relevant one for expressing reflection positivity. I should have said, by the way, that when HN includes a global symmetry group G, then part of the data here is a principal G bundle. That was this equivariant extension of a theory when you couple to a background, not fluctuating, not dynamical, but a background G connection. So that's in there. All right, so we have this involution on these manifolds. Now, what is the field theory? Well, in view of the time, I'm just going to state it. So the field theory is a map from a certain Bordism category of n minus 1 and n manifolds with this HN structure to a category of complex vector spaces. So this is a category whose objects are closed n minus 1 manifolds, and to those we attach a complex vector space, but that complex vector space might be infinite dimensional, so we should allow topological complex vector spaces. And to a Bordism, we get a continuous linear map of those. So that encodes the correlation functions, partition functions, and so on. And hopefully, by now, that's a somewhat familiar story. And now this new structure here, this involution, means that we have an involution on this category. We can take every manifold, for example, when this is the SON, we can take every manifold and reverse its orientation. Yeah, I know. Well, because it'll be a nuclear operator. It'll be trace class. It'll necessarily have a trace. Like the e to the minus tau heat kernel, you see
so
that? E to the minus tau Laplacian has a trace.
The topological vector space is of a certain type, like.
Yeah. Well, the image will contain those, necessarily. Correct, but I'm going to the case where it's invertible and these are one-dimensional, so let's not fuss over that today. Okay. There's also an involution here, which is complex conjugation. So this is orientation reversal, or its cousins related to whatever symmetry group we have. Here we have complex conjugation. And now the definition is a reflection structure on F is a beta equivariant extension. So if we just had spaces with involutions and we ask for a map to be compatible, that's a condition. We ask that the map commute with the involutions. But when we have a categories, that's extra data. So what is this extra data? Sorry, run into the problem of an eraser. Where's an eraser? Ah, right. Oh, okay. At least I didn't need the hockey stick. They're what? Where? Oh, one thing I learned in grad school is you never write on these. That's a theorem. Yeah, you never write on those. So when you have a field theory, before you have this reflection structure, if you have a n minus 1 manifold, you always can make this Bordism, which is simply a cylinder built on it, but we think of both of these as incoming. And the manifold you get here is a kind of dual, categorical dual. And what this gives you is on the vector space f of y dual tensor f of y, we get a map to the complex numbers. And that's a non-degenerate pairing. So in other words, it identifies this with the dual space to f of y. So that's in a usual field theory. And now what does the reflection structure give us? It's a piece of data that basically tells us that gives us an isomorphism of this thing with f of y conjugate. Because it gives us an isomorphism of this dual with this conjugate, which is what I call beta of y. And so since beta has to go over to beta, beta of this is the complex conjugate. And now you see what we get as a Hermitian form. No, I mean, no, in whatever case I get, we'll still have that picture and we'll still get it. But the beta over here is always complex conjugation. So here, whatever involution, but that picture is the same. And so what we get is a Hermitian form attached to every closed N minus one manifold. And so the definition is that F with this equivariant extension, I didn't give it a name, F with reflection, is positive, one second, if this Hermitian form is positive definite for all y. What is y star?
Y bar is y star.
Correct.
Oh, I don't see y bar.
Y star is, if you like, I'll say it in this language. The Bordism category is a symmetric monoidal category, and objects have duals. It's a categorical dual. So y star is the dual. Y bar is this extra structure with beta. Well, it allows us to.
Why isn't there a y bar?
There is a y bar. This y star is isomorphic to y bar. Why is that? Because we have this extra direction, and we can construct y bar by using a hyperplane reflection in that direction, and that's exactly how you construct y star. So it's using this extra direction. But honestly, how much time do I have?
Maybe 10 minutes?
Okay, so I will try to rush through. I'm happy to explain this more, but. If we're in a Bordism category of oriented manifolds, that would be y star. And y star and y bar end up being the same, if you like. So you can just think of those as being the same. Well, the orientation changes, and there's a canonical spin structure on the reversed orientation. That's the yeah. So that's what it is. That's the extra data. The equivariance data is exactly this map. So this is the reflection structure. Thank you.
So is this some kind of notion of Hermitian topological theory?
Yes, you could call it with a reflection structure Hermitian theory. Didn't needn't be topological, by the way. The discussion works if it's not topological. Okay. Right, so now we need to rush. So we need to add two things. So one thing is this notion of extended. And I don't have time. Where was the chalk you brought? I don't have time to. It's yeah, but you need the hockey stick to get there. Both of us need the hockey. Right, so I don't have time to say much about that. Oh, it's that one. Thanks. But let me say that that what it'll do is give us a Bordism category where we have not only n minus one manifolds, but manifolds of lower dimension. So the idea is that the Hilbert space itself is something that depends locally on the space. And of course, the picture of the Hilbert space in a lattice system very much has that idea in it. Then this thing has a structure which includes an n category, which basically means it's something with n different composition laws. There are lots of ways now that we can glue along all the different corners in low dimensions. And so we have to replace this by something with a similar structure. And there's one of the rubs, is that we don't, in general, know a good choice for that sort of thing, unless n is small, like 2. And So I'll just call it C for the moment. So that's what extended means. Now what does invertible mean? Well, invertible is that we have this map. It's like a homomorphism. Preserves all the structure into here. And invertible means that it factors through something that hits only the invertibles. So for example, before I extended, what would it mean to be invertible? Well, to every manifold y of dimension n minus 1, we have this vector space of quantum states. And to be invertible means that that vector space is one-dimensional. It's a line. That's what's invertibility under tensor product. And that means that there's a unique state on each n minus 1 manifold, which, as I say, if we're thinking of this as a low-energy theory, that's the unique vacuum condition that's part of the that thing. OK, well, so this consists of all invertibles. Now, if you have a map out of something, you can think like a ring, and you map into something which are invertibles, then you can take this and go to a quotient now. You see, this is a sub, but now we go to a quotient where we take and we forcibly invert everything in here. So this is an algebraic structure. It has maps. It has compositions. We can talk about when the maps are invertible. If I hit something invertible, then I can always factor down to something where I've already forcibly inverted everything, a kind of localization. And so if the field theory is invertible, then we'll always have a map like this. And why is that a good thing? Well, because if you have a category like this with everything invertible, that's the same as a topological space. So that's the construction of taking, in the inverse, it's the construction of taking a space and extracting groupoids from it. And in this case, we have not only a space, but because we have extra structure here, which I didn't mention, but it's about disjoint union here and over here, kind of tensor product, but then both of these have an extra algebraic structure. So it's not only a space, but it's a space with an extra algebraic structure, a commutative algebraic structure, and that makes this what's called an infinite loop space, or equivalently, a spectrum in topology, not the spectrum of an operator, but a spectrum in topology. So that's what brings us to this stable homotopy theory. And that's all nice, only if we can identify what this spectrum is. And so the main theorem that makes this go is the theorem of Galatius, Madsen, Tillman, Weiss, and extensions by other people, which says that this thing, board n, hn, is, well, written as a spectrum, it's the nth suspension of what I called mthn. So it's exactly the spectrum that appears here. So now you can start to see where this comes from. You see, the field theories are maps. The invertible field theories are maps like this. And assuming the theory is, in addition, topological, then, well, and we just have that category, then that's what it is. So you see that space of field theories is maps out of that. And into what? Well, I'm not going to have time to say anything about that. But that's our choice for where we map here. But justifying that choice, yes, a spectrum, in fact, an infinite loop space. And so, correct. And so to talk about these invertible field theories, I only have to tell you a spectrum. I don't have to tell you anything not invertible. And that's why I can get away and tell you something. And now let me answer, there was a question here, which is these particular choices, there's a subtlety there, but roughly those choices are the universal choices that say, if I know the partition function of the field theory, then there's a unique way to get a fully extended field theory. It's roughly that.
Is this another natural choice for the target? Because what you get is not quite
for. I understand. Let's postpone that discussion for discussions. Okay, now I need the hockey stick. Was there? Oh, there is a string. So let me at least try to say something about the reflection positivity. I think it's this one. Well, one string theory is hard enough. I mean, two string theories. So you see, once we're in this world of these invertible field theories, we have something that we don't have in ordinary field theories, which is a notion of stability. So that's gone from this board. But okay, so you remember that we had this sequence of groups. Hn goes to Hn plus 1. They're in fact inclusions. Goes to Hn plus 2. And then we have this limiting group H. And so similarly, we have this, let me leave a little room, sigma n mthn, this domain for our field theory, that maps to sigma n plus 1 mthn plus 1, which would be the domain of an n plus 1 dimensional field theory, and so on. And now we have a map, our field theory is a map from that into our target. And what we can ask is whether this map actually factors through a map here, and factors through a map here, and so on. So we can do an obstruction theory to see whether it maps there. And you see, that's one part of going from this statement in dimension n for a general local field theory to one which is reflection positive, is that it's what you might call stable. I mean, it factors through to the end. Well, that's a pretty easy, and let me mention, since I'll forget, that we could also, in this framework, I've assumed from the beginning this relativistic invariance, which means it's L-type, I think, in your terminology. But the H-type would also fit in. We would just start one level back, and we could analyze the obstruction for going from H-type to L-type as well. And, well, what sits here in topology would be written as sigma n of B Hn plus 1 plus. That might not be illuminating. But what it says is that you have to restrict your theory to here and give a trivialization of this map. That's how you bring it one step forward. But that has a very geometric story attached to it. Namely, if we look at the homogeneous space, Hn plus 1 mod Hn, that's precisely the n-sphere because of those pullback diagrams. And furthermore, the natural Hn bundle is its Hn structure. So this sphere comes with an Hn structure. It's amusing, by the way, if you think about the case when n is 1 and the group is spin, that means on the circle there's some spin structure that's talked about there. And this whole situation has a symmetry group, which is Hn plus 1. Well, that's what that thing is encoding. And what we have to do is evaluate the theory on this thing, evaluate f. Now, what is f? Well, evaluated on Sn, I'm just getting a number. So typically, we would get a non-zero complex number. And so that's what we would usually get. Now, if I assume this reflection structure, then that reflection structure is acting, let's just say trivially for this purpose, because we have an orientation reversing, or an Hn reversing hyperplane reflection on the sphere. And here it's acting by complex conjugation. So in fact, it ends up sitting in R star, if I have the reflection structure. And so what it's asking to be able to move to here is actually a condition. And the condition is simply that f of the sphere be positive. So the condition to go one step is that f of the sphere is positive, and there's no more condition you can analyze. Once you go there, there's actually no more condition. And what does that have to do? Yeah, sorry, that's the partition function. Yes, that's a number. So because of the reflection symmetry of the sphere, that number will be real. It's non-zero because it's invertible, so it's either positive or negative. So there's a z mod 2 there. And why? What does that have to do with positivity? So let me try to. So what it has to do with positivity is, that's not a good place to go. Pardon me? Well, that's the difference between these targets, so let me. You can imagine that Euler theory, I said lambda to the Euler characteristic, where lambda is a real number that's not zero. You could imagine that. So it needn't be plus or minus one. So Yeah, right. So sorry. So I should have said this picture where we have this manifold Y and Y bar, which is Y star. Supposing that Y is actually the boundary of some N manifold with boundary. Well, then we could take and apply beta, which I'm calling bar, okay, beta of Y, and here's beta of X, and we could glue that onto the top. And what we have here is what's the double of a manifold. It's the double of the manifold with boundary, but in this HN geometry context. And what this computes by F is the norm squared of F of X. You see, F of X is a vector in the Hilbert space of Y, and this diagram computes the norm squared, which of course must be non-negative. So this condition on the sphere is exactly matching this, which is a kind of curved version of the original reflection positivity that's still up there. And so having that, which you definitely need on all doubles, in particular you need it on the sphere, and in fact once you have it on the sphere, you'll have it on all doubles, that's certainly part of reflection positivity. So if you have something that's reflection positive, that will push us to the next stage, and as I say, we can get to the rest of the stage. That's not, however, the end of the story, because what you have at that point is not a map from MTH to there, but you have an equivariant map. So if I just wanted, there's a third statement there, which are deformation classes of these invertible theories on which F of the sphere is positive. And what you would get is not that group, but the group of equivariant maps for the involution beta. And now the rest of the story is to tell how the positivity gets rid of that. And that really is the interesting part of the story, which tells you about how you can try to start to marry this notion of positivity with the notion of an extended field theory. So I really only talked about what positivity means in the usual two-tier theory where I just have partition functions, Hilbert spaces, correlation functions, and Hilbert spaces. But you have to have a notion of positivity all the way down once you go to extended field theory. And so there's a easy way, so to speak. Anyway, it's easy to see kind of what to do in this invertible case when you have homotopy theory, but certainly it's a good question to pursue in the non-invertible case. So thank you. Sorry, go over time.
So going to your Euler character field theory.
Yes.
So the action is lambda times the Euler character.
Lambda to the power of the Euler, yeah.
Sorry?
Lambda to the power of the Euler characteristic. Lambda raised to that power. Because when I take disjoint union, the Euler...
The
action is...
The action is some lambda.
Sorry.
Maybe it's the log of your lambda.
Yeah. Yes.
Times the Euler
character. Yes.
Is there a preferred value of that lambda, or is it completely arbitrary? Do you gain more symmetries for special points, or is it completely generic?
I don't know the answer off the top of my...
Here, there is a preferred value that says this equals to 1. Or minus 1. No, it says it's positive. It's always positive because of positivity. Yes. And you respond in the direction, there's still a parameter. One is probably a preferred value.
What picks one out from the rest?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think I know a good answer. I would like a good answer, but I'm not sure.
You agree that one would be a good place.
Presumably, they are equivalent. Lambda equal to zero or non-zero will be equivalent. So you can pick lambda zero in your definition as a representative of the whole class. So this lambda is a parameter which is
log lambda,
which is within the same class. Different lambda belong to the same class.
No, that's clearly true, but in my old-fashioned language, I would say that this lambda is a local counterpart.
Yes.
Usually we have freedom in that.
Yes.
We adjust that to achieve some good properties.
So okay.
What is the good property to the value zero?
Well, zero, you get the trivial theory. I guess that's the good property.
No.
Sorry, lambda equals one is the trivial theory.
Yeah.
Trivial here is multiplicative. Quantum field theory has been exponentiated. So trivial means one, partition function one.
In what sense is it more trivial than the other?
Because the partition function on any, say, surface is lambda to the Euler characteristic.
Ah.
If lambda is one, it's one. So the whole theory is trivial. So sorry, what picks that out is that's the trivial theory. Yes.
And all the others differ from the local counterpart.
If you like, but in the context of this discussion, they're all connected by a path. So before the reflection structure, we just had lambda a non-zero complex number, and then they're all connected. But with the reflection structure, we now get two components of non-zero real numbers. So now we can distinguish two deformation classes of, you know, not reflection positive theories. And the reflection positivity picks one of those out as a condition. No, I think they're all reflection positive. I don't see why they're not.
Lambda the dimension of some object, and if this object is invertible, it will have to be one.
Well, I was doing a simpler situation where I don't have that picture, I think.
Okay, for sake of time, let's thank you.